It's beautiful.
We're all fascinated with the mashup of different elements in this film. 1970s Los Angeles, sleazy underground, film noir.
Sure.
Harkening back to the 40s. Kind of a crazy Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas humor that creeps in and explodes every once in a while. A nice blend of crazy elements. Talk about it.
It's a good stew, I think. We see, the thing is, you can't concoct something like this out of whole cloth. You have to just sort of breathe it for as many years as we have. Joel has, I have. And I had a leg up working on this with my writing partner, Anthony Bagarozzi, because if you look at the library of my house, I've got every one of these crappy books. And there's, you know, some of them are crap, but there's always a gem. There's always this wonderful bit of pulp in this library of over 1,000 of these detective books that I have that I can pluck from. And so the influences, whether it be Raymond Chandler or even better, Ross McDonald, who really made literature of that noir tough guy, versus just the kind of rougher, more chaotic kind of 60s swinging Private Eye that was so much fun too. And mashing it up, like you said, is I think a great, great idea. It's good to make a stew because not many people make Private Eye movies anymore. And I just wanted to do one. And Anthony read the same books I did, so he wanted to do one. But thank you for noticing that it's kind of this mishmash. I think if you saw another film Joel and I did together, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Brilliant.
But very similar, very much the same tone. It's a different time period, the characters are different, but I think the tone is
similar.
And it comes from standing things on their heads. You take a Private Eye convention, like how many times in a movie have you seen someone doesn't want to give up information, so the good guy takes a revolver, puts one bullet, and spins it, and goes click, click, and it goes, okay, whatever, you're crazy, I'll tell you. Well, you know, we said, well, what if, you know, the click and the first hit that one bullet, you know, bang, and it goes, what the fuck did you just do, you know? And so that's what we love, is that kind of loose, rough rhythm where you take things and you skew them and you stand them on their head and you just have fun within a genre. You know, you make a picture that just plucks from all aspects of the genre that we both love so much, the Private Eye.
Do you think this movie is going to be like, because for me it was so awesome that I think it can like be like a reborn for these type of films, you know? It can be like the trend again when Lethal Weapon was like, you know.
Boy, I sure hope so. I would love to do another one of these with these two guys. I mean, if you look at this version with the various scenes, all these kinds of style setters to sort of introduce this kind of character in these kinds of situations, it's like a tasting menu. This first movie for these two guys, I think there's another case that they could take on.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you've got to, if you like it, please tell somebody. Because we're up against, you know, Birds and Bees and X-Men and, you know, every other damn thing, and they're all branded pieces of entertainment that people know well. And people may have heard of us within the last couple months, but they've been waiting on these movies all year, so we have to get the awareness up.
So, Joel, you have to find the money for these. At this point in the evolution of something that has the potential for a sequel because these two guys have a wonky chemistry together and the girl is to die for. She's so delightful.
Isn't she?
And what thinking goes in from your side as a producer?
I mean, look, Shane and I have done four of these together. We've known each other for 30 years. He brought me Lethal Weapon in 1986. So, yep. I mean, he was 21 years old, and he was just out of UCLA, and that was the first script he really wrote, and we made that and came out in 87. And then we went and did, you know, Last Boy Scout, 91, and then we did Kiss Kiss in 2000. He had a period of introspection, and then in 2005 we did Kiss Kiss, which you know, we were fortunate to get that movie made. I mean, Downey was on his ass, and Val, you know, really hadn't been doing much, and we didn't
been
have a lot
eating
of money.
A lot of it, really.
Yeah, we didn't have a lot of money, but I always believed in Shane, and we believed in Downey, and so, you know, we went and did it, and even though it was very well thought of and people liked it, it didn't have a big budget. It didn't really do what it had to do, but we loved the movie, and we always wanted to revisit it. He'd written this actually before he'd written Kiss Kiss, it was just kind of, you know, he wrote it originally as a contemporary story now, and we couldn't kind of get traction on it. And then he went off and did a little movie called Iron Man 3, which made about $1.5 billion. And then they said, "What do you want to do next, Jane?" And then he said, "Well, what about this?" And he kind of rewrote it for the 70s, where he felt it would really be have resonance. And pretty much right after his 2013 is when he came out with Iron Man 3. And right around then, when he said, "Let's do it," it came together very quickly. I mean, Russell said yes, Ryan said yes, and bam, we were making the movie. And
yeah, and I'll keep coming back to this. Well, I could, because, you know, Joel's had the faith and the you know, consistency to let us make these noir type films, these comedies, thrillers, comedies, whatever you want to call them, caper movies. And the first one, like you said, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, is well thought of internationally. It did okay. It made its money back, but it didn't break through. And so, yeah, I'll keep coming back and hitting that door, or better yet, trying to find a way to get through the window until someone wakes up and says, "You know what? These are pretty damn good, not just as cult midnight movies, you know. I have more midnight movies under my belt than most any other filmmaker." It's like, that's great. Go see it at midnight. I'll tell you what, why don't you see opening day, too? Then see it at midnight. You know, come Thursday at midnight. They have these pre-shows before they open the film, you know. So, I want to get the Private Eye out of the cult and into the mainstream.
How did you do to find the little girl? She's, like, amazing. So how did you...
Yeah, she does, doesn't she?
She steals the show.
Yeah.
That's one of those things actors talk about, babies, dogs, and little girls.
I mean, we'd been casting for the role, and there was a little girl that had been in Crazy Stupid Love, who we thought was going to be the girl. And, you know, she had worked with Ryan. I mean, she was Kim, and she was great. We were all going that direction, and we had this casting director who had worked with Shane on, does all the Marvel movies, Sarah Finn. She said, "I saw this tape of this little girl in Australia, Melbourne, and you should see her, and maybe we should fly her in." So we said, "Let's fly her in." And Ryan was there that day with us, and he did research. He found out all the girls who were coming in. He really was so supportive. I mean, being at the Mickey Mouse show, he knew what it's like to be a little kid and trying to, you know, perform. And he was so good with them, and they all came in, and they all were great. And then out of the last girl in was this little girl flown in from Australia, and just there was nothing to say. I mean, she
sat down with him in a perfect American accent, so to the extent that we didn't even know it was the same girl. Is that the one from Australia? I don't think so. And just started talking to him in character. She came in and just instantly just did it. And actually, some of the things she was doing, I look over at Anthony, my writing partner, he's like making notes, like, "Put this in a script, even if she doesn't get the role." So as soon as someone comes in, sits down, adopts a character, and then starts riffing in a way that actually suggests to the writer that there are changes to be made to the script, that's the one you want, you know?
I remember the day was he wanted to give him a little kind of improv, and he said, "Okay." He took the scene where she wants to go to the party, where she hides in the trunk, and he says he's not going to let you go to the trunk. He tried to convince him that you should go to the party, and some of the little girls, that was an idea that he had. Some of the little girls kind of didn't know how to handle it. It's a miracle how. Look, it's just, you know, I think she has a wonderful opportunity and have a big career, and I think. But, you know, but she has she been here yet?
Have you seen her?
Yeah. She's fantastic.
She's going to come in. She's ultimately kind of shy and a little bit guileless in her way. I urge you to be nice to her. But my God, she'll melt your heart. She will.
She's the movie. They're great. I mean, they are great. But you know, it's a complicated movie in that it's not a comedy. It's a thriller. It's a mystery. It's a hard-boiled picture, but it's just very funny.
It's rough and tough, but then she brings this conscience to it, that it's not just tough guys. It's not just a tobacco-spitting movie. It's got this soul and conscience that she represents. I mean, I looked at movies in the 70s, for instance, like Bad News Bears or Paper Moon, where you had a girl like this, right? And I think that she is that caliber of actress.
Are you worried about corrupting her? You know, some of these scenes, you know?
She is, you know... We had people around her, you know, in the same way that when the little boy discovers the nude girl up front, there was very careful regulation of that. You know, he wasn't allowed to be next to the nude girl. We would have a double or we'd have someone with a drape on, you know. So there's always ways to protect, but she didn't need protecting. She's just a smart kid with a good head on her shoulders. And her mom's there the whole time, and her mom's like a whip, so.
Her mom's their playwright. I mean, she and her dad are, I mean, they're big in the theater community in Melbourne. But you know, she's you know, she just came in a couple. She saw the movie. I mean, it's just it's exciting. It's exciting to see.
It's exciting to see someone who's that good in the movie that you forget she's a little girl, and then she comes in and sees, and she's all excited. Oh, this she is a little girl. Look how excited she is. You know, she's still freaking out that she's got this career ahead of her, but she so obviously does.
She's got this thing going on with Russell Crowe in the movie too. That's quite tender to the point where it'll bring a tear to your eye, and at a certain point, it informs his character, obviously.
Yeah.
But talk about that particular peculiar relationship.
Well, that's an odd one because he's a guy who there's a point in the movie where you know she questions his truthfulness. And that, to me, is the pivotal point, because she is pure, and he sees in her a reflection of the one person that he can't get away with lying to, ever. And I think of all the corrupted people that he's around and sees, there's something special about her, because it's not like she's had a great life. She's had some rough knocks, the same as him, but she hasn't been corrupted, and he has. And he sees that the things he's so casually come to accept, that it's okay, the violence is all right. He's sort of live day by day in this world where you try to improve yourself, but you don't really worry so much about morality. And then he encounters morality in the form of her, and I think it strikes him, you know, to the heart. And I think watching him come round almost as though she's the one to be admired, not the father, is interesting.
That reminded me of Natalie Portman in Leon, that relationship. Was that in your mind at all?
No, not so much. Because I see that as very different, because she was in Leon. I remember she was really tough, and there was that weird dress-up scene where he comes out dressed as different characters. I'm not a big
that creeped you.
Well, I just don't get that film that much. You know? I was not a big Leon fan.
We'll arm wrestle about that one day.
I love La Femme Nikita. But him carrying the plant everywhere.
So I walked out of the screening room thinking sequel, because I enjoyed it so much. But will she age too quickly?
However much she ages, that's the sequel we make.
So you'll put it in the 80s?
Yeah, if we figure it's going to be... Yeah, exactly. And that's something cool, too, is the idea of this sort of landlocked franchise, in this case, time-locked franchise. If we have a sequel... You know, what happened in the 80s that was a big mystery? What could we do? We do one 10 years from now. Now she's a young woman, and we're in the 90s. I mean, there's a potential for a franchise that lags us, that will never quite catch up, but is always informed by, in retrospect, what we perceive a certain era to be like. And I love the idea of examining each decade through one of these movies, which is what Private Eye movies were made for anyway, that sort of timelessness. That's why... We set it in the 70s because there should be a timelessness to the Private Eye movie.
Can you tell us, could you tell us about, sorry, just going into the future, could you tell us anything about Predator?
To the best of my knowledge, the train's rolling. They took some convincing because they've been putting out, you know, these sorts of movies all along, about $50 million budget or 60, and they all had a guaranteed return, but there was never the sense of an event picture. That was sort of more like, oh, I understand that another Predator's coming out. Great, well, maybe we'll see it, maybe we won't. As opposed to 3 months out, you're like, did you hear? They're getting Predator right this time. They're really trying. They're really rolling up their sleeves, and they're going to do a version that, A, bigger budget, bigger cast, and it doesn't have to be big in scale, like huge. It just has to feel like the right tone. And by the way, you're sitting with the man who cut, largely edited the entire picture. You know, John was there, John the director was there, but Joel was in the editing room, as he was with me, and just taking that apart and putting it back together. This is the tone we want. This is the tone he established for the first Predator. Now make it bigger, but keep that tone.
He was in it. He was in the movie, so I mean, he was there. He was in the first Predator.
Didn't he insist on a role?
Well, no, I was trying to con him. I wanted some help on the script, and I thought, you know, he was not willing to. I said, well, if I put him in the movie, he'll be there. He'll be able to help on the script. He wrote a couple jokes for himself there in the movie.
That's the thing. They were writing different versions of the script from the studio. Was saying, well, can't we get more character? They joke. They hang out. They go to Bordello's. They drink beers. And I kind of knew, no, this is it's good the way it is. And so when they came to me and said, can you write something? Oh, I think it's fine. You know, but you're here. Can't you write something? I'm just an actor. And what could they do? Fire me? You know? Yes, they could, actually.
So what stage are you at personally with Predator at the moment?
We start shooting, as far as I know, in the latter part, like in fall, September, October.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.